feeling lost and rudderless. She hadn't known where else to go except to work, because she didn't want to go home and deal with her mother, or rather, her aunt. The lights were on in the office, but she doubted that Benny or anybody else was in, because the only sound was a vacuum cleaner, and the cleaning staff never started until the lawyers had gone. She took a right down the hallway and spotted the black electrical wire running into her office, so she ducked her head in and waved to the cleaner, an older woman who looked up, startled, then waved back with a reassured smile. Judy turned around and walked down the hall to her new war room, where she paused in the threshold taking in the scene. Allegra must have worked her little buns off, because the cardboard boxes were gone, evidently broken down and whisked away. Instead, red accordion files, each one representing a separate case, were lined up on the conference table in three rows, like so many legal dominoes. Next to them sat a stapled list. Judy walked over, set her purse on the table, and picked up the list. "New matters," it read at the top, and she skimmed the list of case captions organized in alphabetical order. Morris Abelman v. Bendaflex Industries, Inc. Sam Atwater v. Bendaflex Industries, Inc. Melissa Baxter v. Bendaflex Industries, Inc. She flipped the pages idly, coming to the end, which was case number 76. Jennifer Zwitz v. Bendaflex Industries, Inc. Judy set the sheet down, reached for the first accordion file, and pulled out the pleading index, a long binder that held all of the papers filed with the court during the case. She sank into a chair at the head of the conference table and flipped through the cleaning index, skimming the complaint, the defendant company's answer, and an endless series of interrogatories, losing focus as she read on. She kept thinking of Frank, hugging her one last time, then her mother, talking about the problem, and Aunt Barb, lying alone in a hospital bed, afraid that she would die before she could answer the questions of her only daughter. And poor Iris, whose death could be mourned, if not completely understood. And a priest, a man of God, dead. Judy let the pleadings of index flop closed, and her thoughts finally came to rest on Domingo, the young man who had translated for her at the barracks. Her heart went out to him, and Iris, Frank, her mother, Aunt Barb, and Father Keegan, as she eased back in her padded chair and faced her damages cases. She realized that she was surrounded on all sides by all sorts of damage. In her work, in her family, in the man she loved, and in the world entire. She closed her eyes, feeling a wave of exhaustion and profound sadness wash over her. Not for herself, but for everyone. And when she felt herself drifting into sleep, she let slumber come, surrendering. She woke up to the sound of her cell phone ringing and opened her eyes, trying to orient herself. She was still in the conference room and the windows were still dark, so it was before dawn. Her cell phone rang again, the sound emanating from her purse, and she reached for it, worried. The call could have something to do with Aunt Barb. Judy opened the flap to her purse and quickly pulled out the phone, and the screen said 506 with an unknown number in the 999 area code. "Hello?" she said, rubbing her face to wake up. "Miss Judy, is that you?" asked a man with a thick Spanish accent, and Judy recognized the voice, though he was slurring his words as if he had been drinking. "Domingo?" "Yes, Miss Judy, it's me. I need to see you. I need to see you right away." "What about?" Judy wondered where he had gotten her cell number, then remembered it was on her business card, which she had given him. "I need money, Miss Judy. I need money to get out of here. I need to go far away from these men, these bad men." "Are you okay?" Judy asked, alarmed. "Have you been drinking?" $1,000, Miss Judy. You have that much money? You are a lawyer." "Where are you, at the barracks?" "No, I left. If you bring me the money, I will tell you what you want to know."
"What do you mean?"
"Bring the money. I know a place to meet. Don't tell anyone, no police, no one else, just you, now."
Now I'm in the city. I don't understand. What'll you tell me?
Pay me, and I will tell you what they did to Iris.
Chapter 36. Judy raced west as the sun rose behind her in a clear sky, spilling brightness into the back window of her VW Beetle. She'd hit the highway before rush hour traffic, having made great time to Chester County. The dashboard clock read 6:15, and she zoomed through East Grove, a small town consisting of an off-brand gas station and a Turkey Hill convenience store. The farther from the city Judy got, the more she left behind what was going on in her personal life and turned her attention to Iris's death. She'd been right that it had been a murder, and that fueled her. She'd tried to convince Domingo on the phone to let her go to the police, but he'd insisted that he wouldn't tell her anything if she did. She'd complied so far, but intended to convince him to notify the authorities, though she had plans even if he didn't. She accelerated onto a paved country road, then turned left and right, following the GPS directions, past fenced pastures with grazing horses in muddy blankets, then long stretches of cornfield, and acres of open space covered with underbrush. She was heading for a sandwich shop in East Grove, which Domingo had said was hidden enough for their meeting, and her heart began to hammer from a half mile away. She took another right, then left, in light traffic, mostly pickup trucks, one full of baled hay, and a rusty red farmer tractor which pulled over to let her pass. She spotted an Agway feed store up ahead. Then the coffee shop came into view, a white shack with a faded sign that read, Haltman's Hoagies. The two stores sat together alongside the road, and beyond them stretched yet another open field thick with underbrush. Then in the distance, a large bluish building with corrugated roof. Birds flew over the building, seeming to congregate, and Judy didn't know why until she pulled into the side parking lot next to the sandwich shop, turned off the engine, braked, and stepped out of the car. The air reeked of compost, and she assumed that the building out back was a large mushroom grower, which could explain why Domingo had said that nobody ate at the sandwich shop. Judy could barely take the stench, trying not to breathe as she hurried past a white Ford pickup, went around the building, and entered the sandwich shop, which was practically empty. Domingo had told her that he'd meet her at 6:30, and she was early, so she didn't worry that he'd be a no-show. There were two rows of small white tables on the right, and on the left was a stop-time soda fountain with an older man behind the counter, wearing a white apron over his t-shirt and pants. He was filling up a line of plastic ketchup bottles, balancing one upside down on top of another, and he looked up when Judy came in.
"What can I do for you?" he asked with a smile.
"Coffee and a donut would be great, thanks."
Judy crossed to the counter and peered at the donut sitting on a cake dish underneath a cloudy plastic dome. Her stomach was too jumpy to eat, but she wanted to get some for Domingo.
"What do you suggest, glazed or plain?"
"I'd suggest you go to McDonald's," the old man answered with a dry chuckle.
"What makes you say that? The smell outside?"
"Heck no, I'm used to that. None of us smell it anymore. I meant the pastry. It's days old and my wife is the baker."
Judy smiled. "I'll take my chances with two glazed and two coffees, please."
She checked her watch, but it was only 6:27.
"Which mushroom grower is back there?"
"In the backfield? That's not a grower. That's the plant where they treat the compost. Then it gets trucked to the growers. The growers don't treat their own compost."
The old man slid the glass pot from an old bun coffee maker and filled a white mug, the pour making a glug-glug sound.
"I didn't know you had to treat compost. I thought it was just horse manure."
"No. It's horse, chicken, and whatever chemicals they put in it. Then they wash it and dry it out. They gotta treat it, you know, make it sanitary to grow mushrooms on it. Big government got its eye out, you know, comes out here to inspect."
The old man put the two mugs of coffee on the yellowed counter, picked up a plate, and lifted up the lid of the cake dish.
"One down, one to go."
"Thanks."
You go pick a table and I'll come serve you.
The old man retrieved two donuts with plastic tongs and put them on the same plate, then reached for a dented stainless steel tray. Perfect. Judy turned around, scanned the tables, and made her way to one in the corner where they wouldn't be seen by anybody who came in. The old man followed her, setting down the coffees and the donut plate with a napkin.
Enjoy your meal, he said, with a wink,
then returned to the counter while Judy sat down, taking the seat facing the door. She put her phone on the table and slung her shoulder bag on the back of her chair. She sipped her coffee, which was bitter and predictably did nothing to settle her stomach. She checked her watch again, and it read 6:33, though when she looked up, Domingo was coming through the door. His young expression looked grave, his handsome mouth an unsmiling line, and his bright dark eyes seemed sunken, as if he had been awake all night, hungover, or both. He flashed her an uncertain smile, and she smiled back as he walked toward her table, removing his hands from the pockets of a black hoodie, which he had on with a t-shirt, low-slung jeans, and flat sneakers.
Domingo, hi, please sit down.
Judy pushed the coffee mug and plate of donuts to his side of the table.
Thank you, I'm so hungry.
Domingo took a chair, gulped some coffee, and set down the mug with a clunk.
Did you bring the money?
Yes.
Let me see.
Okay. Judy reached for her purse, slid out the white envelope, and passed it to him across the table. She'd gotten the cash from the office's petty cash and left a personal check in its place.
Thank you, Miss Judy.
Domingo took the envelope quickly, folded it in half, and stuck it in the pocket of his hoodie.
I am sorry about Carlos, what he did to you.
It's okay.
Your mouth, it hurts from him.
Domingo motioned to his lips.
No, thanks.
How are you?
I'm worried about you.
I will be okay with money. Domingo smiled warmly, seeming to relax. He grabbed a donut and took a big bite, then another.
I go away to New York.
Why there?
My uncle, he washes dishes in a restaurant, a nice restaurant.
Domingo took two more bites and finished the donut. He said he can get me a job. He likes New York very much.
I see it on TV, Saturday Night Live. It looks fun.
It is fun, Judy said, touched.
I had to go away from Carlos and Roberto.
Domingo's brief smile vanished. They are not good men. They are the worst man in the world. Judy got a sick feeling in the pit of her stomach. Are they the ones that killed Iris?
Yes.
Judy swallowed hard. She wanted to know the truth, and at the same time it was too awful to hear.
How did they do it?
Gas.
What kind of gas?
Judy asked, her mouth going dry.
Bug killer.
And they have a bottle, a soda bottle. They mix bug killer and acid. You know acid?
Acid?
Yes, acid. They use to clean plumbing and stones. This is the name. I copy from the bottle. Domingo reached into his other pocket, retrieved a crumpled scrap of white paper, and slipped it to her across the table. Judy opened it up, her heart pounding. On the sheet of paper were two penciled words in capitals. Bonide muriatic.
Is this English?
Yes, yes. Domingo reached his hand across the table and pointed a dirty fingernail at bonide. This kills bugs. Then he moved his finger to muriatic. Mix this, kill people.
Judy gasped. She couldn't speak, horrified. She couldn't bear to imagine the agony of Iris's murder. She couldn't conceive of such cruelty.
Her mind went into denial. Perhaps Domingo had been wrong. She asked him,
How do you know this?
I saw.
Judy stifled a moan. What did you see exactly?
At the barracks, I see them, Carlos and Roberto. Domingo picked up his mug and drained it of coffee.
Roberto who?
Riviera. Domingo picked up the second donut and began to wolf it down.
How did they do it?
They take Iris and put her in the shed. Domingo finished the donut and leaned over the table, his voice urgent.
She screamed, "No, no, the troll bottle in pipe on top. Bottle break in the shed, no more screaming."
Judy forced herself to understand the scene. Why weren't they gassed? They were, Domingo raised his hand and covered his face. Masks?
Yes.
Judy thought it seemed oddly elaborate, and she still doubted him. Why did they kill her that way?
No, at home, the cartel, they do it.
Judy shuddered. Do Carlos and Roberto sell heroin? Domingo hesitated, his tongue licking dry lips.
I don't know.
Judy could see he was lying.
They work for some cartel, don't they? Miss Judy, I don't know. I don't want to say. I tell about Iris, that is all.
Could that be why they killed Iris? Was she working with them, or did she find out about them?
I don't know.
Was anyone there when they killed her?
No.
I don't understand what you were doing there. Did you help them?
No.
Domingo recoiled, blinking. I would never. It's a scene. Where were you?
Domingo paused. Inside.
In the barracks?
Yes.
What were you doing there? Did they know you were there?
No.
Domingo hesitated.
I was with Pablo. In bed, you understand? Carlos and Roberto? They don't know.
Judy got the gist. So Pablo saw them too.
Pablo is married. Nobody know about him, only me. His wife at home, 3 children.
What's Pablo's last name?
Diaz.
Why did they kill Iris?
I don't know.
Are you sure? Judy was trying to piece it together. They didn't say anything, or you didn't hear them talking?
We hear screaming, a woman screaming, then we see.
Domingo shuddered, flattened his lips in disgust.
We want to stop them, but they will kill us too. They are killer.
Domingo slid a silver flip phone from his pocket and checked the clock.
Miss Judy, I have to go. I miss the bus.
Wait. Did they kill Daniela too?
I don't know.
Domingo, we should go to the police. Please, we should tell them.
No, I told you, never.
Domingo's eyes flared with fear. They will kill me. The police would never kill you.
Carlos and Roberto, they will. The police will send me home, but I will not get there.
Domingo rose. Goodbye, Miss Judy. The bus is far to walk. Please, can we go to the police?
No.
But it's the right thing to do.
No.
The police can protect you.
They will not. My mother, my brothers, Carlos will kill my family.
Domingo shook his head. No, no, no. Okay, all right. I'll take you to the bus stop or wherever you need to go. Judy would use the ride to convince him to go to the cops.
Only to the bus.
The bus. Got it.
No police.
No. Okay, thank you. Let's go now. Domingo smiled, grateful. Judy would have to figure another way to convince him. She stood up, got her purse, slid $10 from her wallet and left it on the table, then slipped her phone in her pocket and followed Domingo outside. They fell into step as they turned toward the parking lot, where Domingo pointed at Judy's VW with a grin.
Is your car? It's so cute, like a big tomato.
It is, isn't it? Judy chirped the door open as they walked toward the car.
It's because of the color, like tomato soup.
Yes, I love it. My mother, she always make it for me. Campbell's.
Mine too.
Judy opened the car door, climbed into the driver's seat, and slid the key into the ignition as Domingo went around to the back of the car.
Miss, wait a minute,
someone called out as Judy was about to close the car door. She spotted the old man from the sandwich shop, making his way slowly toward her, trying to flag her down. He walked with a limp, so she climbed out of the car and walked toward him to save him the trouble.
Yes, what is it, sir? You forgot your change.
You can keep it. Judy met him at the corner of the sandwich shop. Don't worry about it.
No, it's too much. The tab's only $3.25.
The old man handed her a fistful of dollars and some change, but Judy waved him off. Please keep it.
No, take it.
The old man got distracted a moment, looking past Judy and gesturing at the parking lot.
Ha! I think your friend likes the car.
What? Judy turned around to see Domingo sliding into the driver's seat of her VW, flashing her a big grin. She called to him.
Domingo, you look damn good in there.
I know that's right.
Domingo beeped the horn, turned on the ignition, and burst into laughter. Suddenly, there was an ear-splitting boom. The VW exploded into a white, hot fireball. Metal and plastic debris flew into the air. The percussive blast hurled Judy backwards. And everything went black. Chapter 37. Judy woke up on her back in the parking lot. She felt stunned. She couldn't keep her eyes open. She couldn't think. Her head rang. She didn't know how long she had been lying there. The air reeked of smoke, gasoline, and burning rubber. Chunks of metal, broken glass, and charred debris lay everywhere. She couldn't hear a thing. She propped herself up on her arm and saw the old man lying on his side, his face blackened. He was moving and didn't look injured. Her thoughts cohered in a terrifying moment. Oh, my God. She looked around her in horror. Bright orange flames engulfed her car, raging through the interior. The conflagration obscured Domingo in the driver's seat. She scrambled to her feet, reeling. Oh, no, no. Domingo! She screamed in anguish. She had to get Domingo out of the car. She staggered to the VW. She didn't know how long the fire had been burning. Black smoke filled the air, fogging everything. She lunged to the car, but raging flames drove her back. She reached into her pocket for her phone, scrolled frantically to the phone function, and pressed 911. Please, hurry, I have an emergency, an explosion, a car fire. Judy couldn't hear the operator or her own voice, but kept shouting, I need an ambulance right away. There's somebody trapped in the car. We're at Haltman's Hoagies in East Grove. Please hurry. I'm hanging up because I can't hear anyway. Judy put her phone away. Her eyes watered, her throat and nostrils filled with smoke and soot. She gasped for breath. She covered her mouth and tried to get to the car. Flames licked at her, keeping her at bay. Her cheeks and chest burned. Tears streamed down her cheeks. She coughed and coughed. Heat seared her face. Fiery debris flew like a nightmare blizzard blocking out the sky. Domingo! Domingo! Judy tried to get to the car one more time. The sleeve of her blazer caught fire. She beat the flames with her hands, smothering them. Agonizing pain exploded in her palm. She couldn't let Domingo die. Her thoughts raced ahead. The sandwich shop must have had a fire extinguisher. She whirled around and ran back to the shop through the smoke. A yellow Mini Cooper had stopped at the curb. Two young girls jumped out of the front door, surveying the scene with horror. Help the old man! Judy yelled to them. The young girls yelled back to her, something she couldn't hear. One young girl raced to the old man, who was struggling to his feet. The other young girl started talking into a cell phone, probably calling 911. Judy bolted to the sandwich shop, ran inside, and looked wildly around. A small red extinguisher was affixed to the lower wall by the door. She yanked it off and raced outside with it, frantic. She sprinted past the old man and the young girls. Cars were slowing on the street and pulling to the curb to help. Judy ran to her VW. An inferno raised the interior. Flames raged skyward. Smoke billowed everywhere. The heat beat her backwards. Her eyes burned in the smoke. She couldn't accept that Domingo was dead. She tucked the fire extinguisher under her arm and pulled out the steel ring on top. Behind her, a trio of Good Samaritans helped the old man to his feet. She recognized one of them, a priest.
Father Vega?
Judy's heart leapt with hope.
Thank God, help!
Judy? Father Vega looked over and ran toward her through the smoke. His black jacket flying open. He reached her, his eyes wide with alarm.
What are you doing here? Is that your car? Yes, my friend's inside.
Judy tugged the rubber hose on the extinguisher from its holder and aimed the nozzle at the fire.
Hurry! Squeeze the black handle, spray the car, sweep it from side to side. On it!
Judy squeezed the handle and aimed the nozzle. Acrid pale yellow powder sprayed at the huge flames, though it looked futile. She didn't know what else to do. She glanced at Father Vega and caught him sliding a hunting knife from his jacket pocket, its jagged blade glinting in the sun. The priest was turning toward her, his eyes blazing darkly as he raised the knife in his hand. "Father Vega?" Judy gasped, thunderstruck. She couldn't begin to comprehend what she was seeing with her own eyes. A man of God about to stab her with a lethal knife. And behind him at the curb, jumping out of a battered white pickup, were Carlos and another man, presumably Roberto. Chapter 38. Judy couldn't believe what was happening. She had thought Father Vega was so kind, but she'd been horribly wrong. It shocked her, but it was unfolding before her. The priest must have been in cahoots with Carlos and Roberto. Father Vega charged at Judy with the hunting knife. "No!" Judy aimed the nozzle of the fire extinguisher at him and sprayed his face with the powder. "Ah!" Father Vega cried in pain. His hands flew to his face. He dropped the knife and staggered backwards. Judy swung the extinguisher toward his head and slammed it into his temple. The priest fell to the ground, and the old man, girls, and good Samaritans wheeled around, a confused group. Behind them, at the curb, Carlos raised an assault rifle and Roberto a handgun, aimed at Judy and the group. They must have followed Domingo to the sandwich shop and planted the bomb on her car. They tried to kill her and Domingo. Now they were going to finish the job.
"Watch out! They have guns!"
Judy screamed. Roberto fired his weapon. Suddenly, red blood spurted from the cheek of one of the girls, who dropped to her knees and fell over.
Pop, 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 pop!
Carlos fired the assault rifle, but Judy was already running for her life. She raced past the burning car and through the parking lot. The smoke and the fire screened her from Carlos's view. There were woods behind the sandwich shop, and she ran into it as fast as she could, struggling not to trip on sticks and underbrush. Tree trunks and limbs exploded on her right, spraying jagged wood chips where bullets hit. She kept her legs churning, full tilt. She zigzagged between the trees. Their limbs had grown together everywhere. Vines wound around branches, blocking her path. She pinwheeled her arms to get through them. Tree limbs and thorns scratched her face and clothes. She veered around one tree, then the next, not knowing which direction she was heading. Her only thought was to run away. Her chest heaved. Her heart pumped with exertion and terror. She coughed and spit. She caught a flash through the trees of the sloped gray roof of the treatment plant, with steel pipes sticking out of the top. She crashed through the woods, trying to think. Carlos and Roberto couldn't drive a truck through here. They had to chase her on foot. She had a head start. She was younger and in better shape. She had a fighting chance if she could make it to the treatment plant. There would be help there. She thought of shouting for help, but that would give away her position. Police would arrive soon. She had to stay alive until then. Hope fueled her. She kept going, the idea of salvation powering her anew. She heard her own ragged breaths. Her hearing was fully back. She heard gunshots behind her and put on the afterburners. A herd of deer sprang from the underbrush away from her, their stiff white tails high. She kept running and whacked aside the vines as she went. She stumbled, tripping on the gnarled root of a tree. She kept her balance and staggered forward. She veered left and caught another glimpse of the treatment plant. She was getting closer. Birds and turkey vultures circled overhead. Her nostrils were too full of soot to smell anything. Gunshots popped behind her, a lethal series. It was too close for comfort. She bolted ahead in terror. She kept going, running straight. She didn't dare look back. Carlos was running after her. Roberto could be with him. It was two against one. They had weapons. Judy felt rising panic, but fought it. She couldn't give up now. She had to get to the police. She had to put Carlos and Roberto away for Iris and the others. She had to tell the police what Domingo had told her. Then she remembered. My phone. Judy had recorded her conversation with Domingo on her phone, unbeknownst to him. She had every word he'd said on the tape, in case she couldn't persuade him to go to the police. She never dreamed that he would be murdered. Domingo would help her bring his own killers to justice, even though he was gone. Her phone bounced around in her pocket. She raced toward the treatment plant with her precious cargo. She would get to the police or die trying. Chapter 39. Judy ran closer to the treatment plant, soaring with hope. She was almost there. Her lungs felt like they were about to burst. Her stomach cramped. Her legs burned, but she kept them churning. She pumped her arms, ignoring the ache in her shoulders. She kept going, getting closer, catching a clear view of a commotion at the plant. For such a large operation, there seemed to be only a handful of employees, and they were gathering in a parking lot in front of a boxy building like an office. Judy almost cried with happiness. They would help her. She was almost there, only 300 yards away. She veered toward them, changing course. She didn't call out because she didn't want to give away her position to Carlos and Roberto. She sprinted closer and saw the plant employees quickly dispersing to trucks and cars, then speeding off down a side road, spraying gravel and dust. She realized that the road led back to the sandwich shop. The employees must have seen the car fire or heard gunshots. They were leaving the treatment plant to go help. No, no, no! Judy almost shouted to them, but stopped herself. If she called to them now, she'd draw fire for sure. Carlos had an assault rifle, and he would shoot them all. She couldn't cause any more death. She ran harder than she ever thought possible. Tears of fright sprang to her eyes. There had to be somebody left at the plant, didn't there? They wouldn't all leave, would they? Cars and trucks drove off down the road at speed. She kept a bead on the office. Two cars were left in the lot. There had to be somebody there, or maybe a weapon. Or maybe she could lock herself in a room until the police arrived. Judy ran and ran on her way to the edge of the woods. She could see ahead that the trees ended in a trash area filled with dumpsters, the parking lot, and the door to the office. She would be exposed as soon as she got out of the woods. Her only hope was that Carlos wasn't looking to the right. She prayed he was running straight for the treatment plant, the way she had been before she changed course. Judy burst out of the woods and raced over the blacktop and past the dumpsters. She flung open the office door and flew inside. She found herself in a bright entrance hall that was quiet and empty. She ran through it to the next door, which led to a short hallway with an office on either side.
Help me!
She called out, barely able to catch her breath, running past the empty offices, but there was no response. She looked around frantic for a place to hide, but didn't see any. She tested the door to the last office, but it didn't lock. She flew back down the hall into a coffee room with brown cabinets, stopping at a wall phone. She snatched the receiver off the cradle, pressing 911, and couldn't wait for the call to connect.
Help! Help! She said, her chest heaving. I'm at the treatment plant in East Grove. I'm being chased by men with guns. They killed people at the sandwich shop. Please hurry.
She left the receiver hanging and took off running. She heard a noise behind her in the office area. She glanced back reflexively at the sound. Nobody was there, but they must have been coming. She almost cried out for help, but she couldn't be sure if it was an employee or Carlos. She burst through the door at the end of the hall into a cavernous building, as big as a warehouse but completely empty. The concrete floor was wet, as if it had just been hosed down. She didn't see any employees or any place to hide. The air was warm and wet. A tractor trailer with an empty container sat parked in the open door. Thick, industrial orange and yellow hook hoses lay nearby. Her heart leapt at the distant sound of sirens. The police were finally getting there. Help was on the way. All she had to do was stay alive. She heard another noise behind her in the office area, the distinct slamming of a door, then men speaking Spanish. She didn't recognize the voices. She still didn't know if they were employees or Carlos and Roberto. She raced from the empty room, through another door, and almost plowed into a big white cylinder on a cart. Heat Star, it read, but she couldn't use it as a weapon or anything else. She bolted past it into another huge room with a wet floor, looking around wildly for help. The air was hot and more humid. There was nobody. A 20-foot-tall green machine that read Christian's Group sat on a rail close to the wall. She bolted behind it to see if it would hide her, but it wouldn't. She looked up, her heart pounding. Gray piping of all kinds was suspended from the corrugated ceiling. None of it could help her. The police siren sounded closer. So did the men speaking Spanish, calling to each other. They were angry, their words staccato. It had to be Carlos and Roberto. Judy's heart thundered with terror. Adrenaline poured into her system. She had to think of something. She had to save herself. She spotted a stairway of stainless steel that went from the floor to ceiling and led to a conveyor belt with a sign. Danger. Pinch points. Peligro. Puntos de ajustamiento. She would have to run up it, but it didn't lead anywhere except the conveyor belt. She wheeled around in panic. She ran to a black tractor trailer that sat parked underneath the conveyor belt. Heat emanated from its massive engine. The driver must have just abandoned it. He could have left the keys in the ignition. She clambered onto the rubber step to the cab, but there was no key. Police sirens cut the air outside, closer but not here yet. Carlos and Roberto had fallen silent. Judy didn't know where they were. She had to get out of sight. The hall from the office would lead them directly here. Her panicky gaze found a skinny middle ladder that was part of the truck going up the side. She jumped onto the closest rung and scrambled to the roof of the container. There was barely a foot between the top of the truck and the corrugated ceiling of the room. She flattened down just in time to see light spill from the door. The silhouette of a short, muscular man stood in the threshold. In his hand was a handgun. She bit her lip, not to cry out in fear. It had to be Roberto, because Carlos had a rifle. She turned her head and pressed it flat against the metal roof of the container, which was covered with grit and dirt from the road. She couldn't risk raising her head or she would be seen. Instead, she watched Roberto's shadow moving on the floor. He entered the room and walked around, raising his gun. He was looking for her. He was going to kill her. Judy remained perfectly still. She could hear his footsteps faintly in heavy boots. He was trying to walk quietly. She breathed as shallowly as possible. The heat in the room made it hard to inhale. She pressed her face and cheek against the roof of the container. Suddenly, a shifting movement caught her eye on the other side of the vast room by the open roll-top door. It was a man. He walked into view, and even at a distance, she could see it was Carlos, raising his rifle. Terror shot through her. The police siren sounded closer, but Carlos and Roberto were in no hurry. She forced herself to think. She had to do something. She realized that Carlos and Roberto couldn't see each other because the truck was in the middle. She would lose the opportunity if they kept moving. She swept her hand slowly over the surface of the container, feeling the grit for the biggest rock. She found one, closed her hand around it, and waited for the right moment. She tried to control her breathing and her fear. She blocked out the sound of the police sirens. She cleared her head of any other thought. She watched silently as Carlos walked farther into the room. Then Roberto's shadow vanished, which meant that he was well out of the doorway and closer into the room. But the two killers still couldn't see each other. Now. Judy pitched the rock in Roberto's direction and heard it ping off something metal. Carlos responded instantly, swinging the rifle back and forth, spraying gunfire. Shots reverberated at deafening levels throughout the corrugated room. A man cried out in pain, then moaned. The gunfire ended abruptly. Judy realized her move must have worked. One of the bullets had caught Roberto. She kept her head down and flat. Her ears rung. She didn't dare peek to see what was going on. Smoke hung in the air. She heard footsteps running across the room. Carlos yelled furiously in Spanish from right in front of the truck. Roberto groaned and moaned, crying piteously. Suddenly, another barrage of gunfire went off, then ended abruptly. Judy squeezed her eyes shut. Carlos had just killed Roberto. He would kill her if he discovered her. She gritted her teeth to stay in control of her emotions. She couldn't predict whether Carlos would go or stay, whether she would live or die. She held her breath. Chapter 40. Judy stayed as flat as she could on the top of the container. She heard the sound of heavy footsteps walking away. She spotted Carlos's shadow turning around in the light from the door. He raised his gun as he scanned the space for her. Every muscle in her body clenched with fright. Police sirens screamed louder and closer. Carlos must have heard them. He was running out of time and he knew it. He edged backwards toward the door. She prayed he kept going. In the next moment, he turned around, faced the door, and hustled from the room. Judy thought about staying, but worried he'd come back. She had to keep moving. She had to know where he was. She got up from the container roof so quickly she bumped her head on the ceiling. She was too adrenalized to feel a thing. She got low, scrambled around like a crab, and climbed down the ladder as fast as she could, jumping to the wet concrete floor. She couldn't go to the right because Carlos had gone that way. She turned left and ran to the open door of the vast room. Massive industrial fans whirred in the ceiling, masking the sound of footsteps as she raced across the concrete floor. Her heart pounded. Her breath came ragged. She reached the door, squinting from the bright sunlight. The police siren sounded closer, almost at the sandwich shop. She prayed they had gotten her 911 message from the treatment plant, but she couldn't wait for help to come. She scanned the yard to see where she could hide. The area was paved almost a city block, and on the left stood massive rectangular bales of hay, 12 feet tall and 30 feet wide. There had to be 40 of them in the field. And beyond them rose hill-sized mounds of dark brown compost with smoke trailing from their peaks. Judy clung to the corrugated inside of the room. The big fans whirred overhead. She had to plan her next move, or it would be her last. She could run to the hay bales. She could go from one to the next, hiding from Carlos until the police came. She would be exposed as she sprinted across the concrete, but she was out of options. She spotted Carlos pop from behind one of the hay bales, his back turned. He had anticipated her move. He was going from one bale to the next, searching them for her. She couldn't go that way. She tucked herself from view, waiting for the right moment, keeping an eye on Carlos. Carlos disappeared behind the next hay bale, and she made her move. She darted out of the doorway, turning left, away from where she'd seen him. She ran as hard as she could across the concrete yard, dangerously exposed. Birds and turkey vultures flew overhead. Police sirens sounded at the sandwich shop. Judy kept running, almost slipping. Filth and muddy tire tracks covered the yard. Huge trucks and equipment sat parked willy-nilly, stopped where they were when the employees had left. She skidded as she raced past a yellow truck pulling a coiled red hose, then three front-end loaders that had their buckets in the air. They offered her no place to hide, but she veered in front of them so they would block her from Carlos. She bolted to a cinder block building that looked like an operations office. She flung open the door, but but passed up the office because it had four glass windows on the other side that would show her hiding there. She whirled around. Behind her lay a huge concrete structure as tall as a single-story house, with a heavy green rail system over the top. The structure was open on the side facing her, only a roof over six cinder block bins. The bins had a foot-high shield at the front bottom. She could see in a flash that the four closest bins were empty, their concrete sidewalls brown with filth. The fifth bin had a dirty dump truck parked in front, its bed in the inclined position. The sixth bin looked closed, roped off with yellow caution tape and an official-looking safety notice. She realized that the bins were where raw manure got dumped, but they could save her life. Carlos wouldn't suspect she would go in that direction. The fifth bin had enough manure to bury herself in. She could hide behind the structure or run back in the woods. Police sirens screamed louder. Carlos would be back any minute. If Roberto had driven their white pickup truck to the plant, it would be parked in front of the office. Carlos would have to run back this way to get the truck and escape the police. Judy had to do something fast. She sprinted behind the bin structure. The woods were on her left, but too far away. She would be exposed for too long if she ran that way. Carlos would cut her down and take off in the truck. On her right was the back of the concrete structure, and it was her only hope. The back of each bin had a heavy, mechanized door that closed across the middle. She ran past the first five bins because their doors were chained and padlocked. She ran to the sixth bin, on the end, roped off. A handwritten sign read, "Gears broken. Do not use." The doors of the roped-off bin were open a crack, but there was no chain or padlock. Judy looked around wildly. She had no other choice. She ducked under the caution tape, wedged her hands between the top and bottom doors, and yanked with all her might trying to open the door. She moved them 6 inches apart, then a foot, then a little more until they jammed, immovable. Her heart pounded with fear and exertion. The space between the doors looked almost big enough for her body. She heard Carlos running in the concrete yard, cursing in Spanish, his rage boiling over. She was out of time. She launched herself into the opening, scrambling inside the bin, scraping the outside of the door with her legs and knees. She squeezed inside, wrenching her arm at the socket. She slid down along the filth of the door, keeping a hard grasp of the lid so she wouldn't make a noise when she hit the bottom. She eased herself onto the floor. Raw manure covered the bin bottom. Carlos ranted 50 feet away. She made herself as flat as possible against the back of the bin. Her body was hidden by the foot-high rim at the front of the bin. She squeezed her eyes and lips shut. She stuck her face into the crack between the door and the floor, burrowing down into the manure and the darkness. The stench filled her nose. Her gorge rose with disgust. She had to stay calm. Carlos was only 20 feet away, cursing in frantic Spanish. The police sirens blared louder and louder. The cruisers were coming down the road to the treatment plant. They must have gotten her 911 call. They were on the way. They were going to rescue her just in time. Judy had to stay alive for just a few more seconds. Carlos must be looking for her, turning this way and that. She could hear footsteps on the gritty concrete and hear the scrape of his boots. He would have to leave any second. He was cutting it so close. The police were almost here. Judy willed herself to keep her wits about her. If she wanted to live, she had to stay still and silent. Suddenly, in her blazer pocket, her phone started ringing. Chapter 41. Judy reacted instantly, desperate. She grabbed the phone from her pocket and sent it slipping along the mucky floor so the ringing came from the far side of the bin. Carlo started firing, but aimed a deafening volley at the bin next to her. Scattered bullets punched holes in the front rim of her bin. She bit her lips not to scream. Abruptly, the gunfire stopped. Smoke drifted into the bin. Her phone rang and rang.
"Freeze, right there!" an officer shouted. "Police, put your weapon on the ground! Put your weapon on the ground!"
Judy could only imagine the standoff outside. The police would train their guns on Carlos, thinking he would give up. She knew better. Carlos wanted her dead, even if he was captured alive. He had nothing to lose and everything to gain from her murder. He wanted her silenced for good. Her phone finally went quiet.
"Keep lowering your weapon," another officer yelled. "Lower it and put it on the ground. Put your weapon on the ground."
Judy's heart pounded like it was trying to get out of her chest. She knew what Carlos would do next. He would shoot the policeman. It sounded like only two cops. Carlos was waiting for just the right moment, tricking the police by lowering his weapon. She couldn't let that happen. She squeezed both hands around some manure, closed her fists, and jumped up. Carlos was standing 5 feet from the bin, facing her direction, his gun slightly lowered. She hurled the manure at Carlos's eyes, then sprang out of the way. Carlos shouted in surprise. His hands flew up reflexively, firing shots wildly into the air. Judy dove toward the floor for safety just in time to see Carlos lose his balance, whirl away from her, and recover fast enough to aim his weapon at the police. Pop, pop, pop! The police responded with a barrage of firepower. Judy landed on the bottom of the filthy bin. She heard Carlos cry out. Then he went silent. The gunfire stopped. Judy lay perfectly still, afraid to move. She kept her eyes closed. She was in no hurry to get up and see Carlos's bullet-ridden body, even as much as she hated him. She opened her eyes slowly, but didn't understand what she was seeing amid the brown manure that lay everywhere. A bright patch of white and green paper stood out in the bottom seam of the bin. She reached for it instinctively and pulled. A $20 bill came from underneath the floor of the bin, attached to another $20 bill, like Kleenex out of the box. Astounded, she dug her fingers in the seam and pulled out a $5 bill and realized that the manure bin must have had a false bottom.
"Miss, are you okay?"
the police officers asked, rushing over.
"Look at this, guys,"
Judy answered, digging for more money. Chapter 42. Judy sat at the conference table in the mayor's office at the Kennett Square police station, having finished giving her statement to a room packed with law enforcement personnel, including Detective Boone and two other detectives, three assistant district attorneys, and a fleet of FBI, DEA, and ICE agents who sat in the back of the room taking rapid notes. The press thronged outside the building, their news vans, reporters, and cameramen visible through the old-fashioned Venetian blinds. Before her statement, Judy had asked the police to contact her mother and her office to let them know where she was. Then she had been photographed in her filthy clothes for purposes of the investigation, and finally showered in the locker room for female officers and changed into a KSPD sweatshirt and sweatpants one of them had lent her. Given the stink of the manure on Judy's skin, she doubted the female officer would want her sweat clothes back. Judy's filthy phone sat on the table between her and the law enforcement authorities, next to the silvery recording devices from the various agencies and Domingo's scrap of paper that read, "Bone-eyed and muriatic." She had explained everything that had happened at the barracks last night, then what Domingo had told her this morning, playing the recording for them from her phone. Her eyes had filmed at the sound of Domingo's voice, but she'd kept it together. She consoled herself with the notion that Father Vega was in federal custody and charged with an array of crimes, as well as being investigated for the death of Father Keegan. Carlos and Roberto had met their end, but Judy was enough of a lawyer to wish that they'd rot in jail for the rest of their lives. Luckily, they hadn't succeeded in killing the two young girls from the Mini Cooper, the old man at the sandwich shop, or the Good Samaritans. The one girl had been hospitalized, but was expected to recover. Judy met Detective Boone's eye. So, how much money was under the manure bin? I'm not sure it's been counted yet. Detective Boone kept his tone official, but not unkind. Ballpark it for me, would you? Judy understood his reluctance, reading the body language of the FBI behind him, a collective stiffening of postures that were already stiff, in suits and ties. We are not at liberty to discuss that, Judy. I think I've earned the right to know, don't you? Modesty aside, nobody would have found any money but for me, and I almost got killed in the process. Chester County appreciates your efforts, and as we've already said, you are to be commended as a private citizen for... Please just answer the question. Judy felt too raw and exhausted to mince words. We both know what a pain in the ass I can be. Detective Boone almost smiled. Fine. It will be in the newspaper, so I'll tell you. Estimates are about $760,000. Wow. Judy didn't hide her surprise. Plus the $50,000 that was in my aunt's house. That's a major drug ring, isn't it? Do you think they were dealing heroin? I cannot give you any further details. Did you find any money under the other bins or elsewhere at the treatment plant? I'll keep it confidential. You have my word. Not the point. It's police business. And given that you almost lost your life today, you should understand completely the dangerousness of the criminals we're dealing with. Please. Judy thought of Iris and couldn't let it go. I know how they killed Iris, but I still don't know why. Can't you fill me in on your investigation or your next steps? It's no longer our investigation. We'll keep a hand in, but the federal agencies are asserting primary jurisdiction at this point. They will liaise with us, but they're running the show now. Detective Boone gestured to the men behind him, and Judy could see from the tightness around his mouth that he wasn't any happier than she was about the current state of affairs. Well, what do you think is going on here, gentlemen? Judy raised her voice, addressing the room in general. Again, we're not going to discuss that with you, Detective Boone answered, presumably for all of them. I'm no expert, like you gentlemen, but it must be some type of heroin ring, right? We found where they stashed their money, or at least one of the places they stashed their money. Judy figured she could think out loud and watch them for reaction if they weren't going to tell her anything. She thought of the money stored in her aunt's house, now safely in the bank, and she remembered what John Foxman had said about banking laws. So they're selling heroin and making lots of cash, but they have nowhere to store it. They can't put it in the bank, so they have to launder it. And I'm betting we found their hamper. Sorry, I found their hamper. Judy, I'm not about to speculate with you. Detective Boone closed his notebook, but Judy continued talking. USDA inspections take place at the treatment plant, but the government inspects the treated manure, not the raw manure. Hiding the money under the false bottom was pretty smart. Judy noticed one of the FBI agents frowning, so she knew she was right. Now, it seems unlikely that so much money was hidden at the treatment plant without some of the higher-ups knowing about it. And maybe they're in on it with Father Vega, Carlos, Roberto, or other employees at Mike's Exotics. Maybe even Mike himself. Judy realized that some East Grove police could be involved, since that was where Mike's, the barracks, and the plant were located, but she didn't say so out loud. She did, however, notice that no police personnel from East Grove were present at the meeting. In any event, it looks like we have a conspiracy to deal heroin and launder money, right here in lovely Chester County.
Boys, you have your work cut out for you.
Detective Boone set his pen down. I think we're finished here, unless anyone has any further questions.
Wait. Hold on, Judy said, thinking of Aunt Barb. Can I ask you a question about Iris? I know my aunt will want to know.
Go right ahead, Detective Boone answered, his voice gentler, and Judy sensed he had a soft spot for Aunt Barb.
Was Domingo right that if you mix bonide and muriatic acid, they produce a gas that can kill you?
Yes.
How does that work exactly?
Judy would Google it later, but she wanted to get the official version.
Bonide is a brand name of a common pesticide on farms, and muriatic acid is a form of hydrochloric acid. It's used in lots of applications around the house or a farm. Masons use it to clean flagstone and the like. These are common chemicals that, when mixed together, produce a poison gas.
Judy swallowed hard. Would Iris have suffered a long time?
No. Death is almost instantaneous.
Almost. Judy's stomach turned over. I bet that's how she broke her nails, trying to get out of the shed. Look on the floor of the shed. I bet you find the nail tips. Little rhinestones.
Will do.
And the car window. Why do you think it was open? Maybe they thought some gas would cling to her clothes or hair?
Judy didn't pause for an answer because she could see that she wasn't getting one. Her heart ached for Iris, Domingo, and the others.
What about Daniela?
We're investigating.
Did you look at the barracks? If they killed Iris there, they could have killed Daniela there too.
We're looking into it.
Do you think she's still alive? We don't want to speculate.
Judy felt another pang at so much loss.
You know what I don't get? Why did the pathologist say Iris had a heart attack in the autopsy report?
Because she did. Hydrogen sulfide gas causes the organs to shut down, resulting in a heart attack. Unlike carbon monoxide, it doesn't turn the skin cherry red or any other color.
So it looks like a natural death, but it isn't.
Yes. The only way the gas would be detectable at autopsy is that it sometimes leaves a faint, rotten egg smell in the organs. But the pathologist had a head cold. We think that's how he might have missed it, if he did.
Judy cringed inwardly. Can they confirm that's how she died?
The coroner can confirm it by ordering a special test of her blood for the gas. That takes a month or so to do, but it's easily done.
Detective Boone paused, glancing over his shoulder at the FBI, DEA, and ICE types.
I can tell you that it's becoming more common in rural areas like ours as a way to commit suicide. We've had cases where people mix the chemicals in the car, then close themselves inside. We started hearing about it last year and put the word out to first responders. We send in the hazmat unit to respond to a suicide like that.
How sad, Judy blurted out, the horror of the day catching up with her. She sensed that the meeting was over because the FBI men were slipping their notepads inside their breast pockets, and even Detective Boone stood, brushing down his slacks again.
Judy, please don't speak to the press. If they call you or show up at your office.
Of course not. I know the drill.
Judy stood up, gesturing at the table.
I'm assuming you want to keep my stinky phone for evidence?
Yes, thank you. Might be time for an upgrade, huh?
You think? Judy managed a smile, and Detective Boone guided her to the door.
I've arranged for a uniformed officer to give you a lift back to the city, considering your service to the county today.
Thanks. Judy flashed on the horrific explosion in her VW. It gave her a jolt, but she had to put it behind her for now.
Detective Boone held open the door, and the other Chester County detectives, ADAs, uniformed officers, and FBI, DEA, and ICE agents gathered around her, thanking her and handing her a flurry of business cards with gold seals and embossed badges.
I'll take you out back to avoid the press,
Detective Boone said after the goodbyes were finished, leading her out the door, through the crowded waiting room, and out a side door down a hallway. Judy let herself be steered past a time clock next to a tray of metal slots filled with punch cards, then a scheduling board covered with wipe-off magic marker notations, out the back to a small police parking lot. The sunlight was waning, and without her phone, she had no idea how long she'd been inside.
"What time is it?" Judy asked, disoriented.
4:30. Detective Boone gestured to a uniformed police officer who stood waiting beside a Kennett Square police cruiser, its back door open.
"Thanks for the ride."
"We're happy to do it. Officer Kit will be your driver. Tell him where to take you."
Detective Boone put a paternal hand on her shoulder.
"Thanks for everything you did. While we appreciate your efforts, I'm officially informing you that we hope you never do it again."
"I won't."
"Maybe."
Judy smiled. "Will you keep me posted?"
"No."
"Oh, come on," Judy whined, and Detective Boone didn't suppress a wry smile.
"Okay, if there's anything you need to know, I will."
"I wish I understood why they killed Iris or what she was doing with the money."